Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading.
Hello, this is Daphne, and I am reading the Cape Cod Times for Thursday, March 28th, 2024. We begin with the weather. Today, heavy rain, watch for flooding, high of 49. Tonight, rain, low of 40. Friday, breezy with periods of rain, high of 46, low of 36. Saturday, sunny and windy, high of 55, low of 36. Sunday, clouds breaking for some sun, high of 49, low of 36. And Monday, sun and some clouds, high of 50, low of 37. The sun rose today at 6:30 and set at 7:02, which gives us 12 hours and 32 minutes of daylight. And on to the lottery for the numbers game. Drawn on Wednesday, March 27th, yesterday, the midday drawing, the numbers were 0, 2, 6, 5. Again, the midday drawing yesterday for the numbers game, 0, 2, 6, 5. And the evening drawing for Wednesday, March 27th, the numbers are 4, 0, 8, 0. Again, for the evening drawing, 4080. For mass cash, drawn yesterday, Wednesday, March the 27th, the numbers are 11, 12, 18, 27, and 30. Again, for mass cash, Wednesday, March 27th, the numbers are 11, 12, 18, 27, and 30. For Powerball, drawn yesterday, Wednesday the 27th, the numbers are 37, 46, 57, 60, 66, and the Powerball of 8. Again, Powerball drawn yesterday the 27th, the numbers are 37, 46, 57, 60, 66, and 8. For Mega Millions, drawn on Tuesday, March the 26th, the numbers are 7, 11, 22, 29, and 38. And the Mega Ball is 4. Again, for Mega Millions, drawn Tuesday the 26th, the numbers are 7, 11, 22, 29, 38, and the Mega Ball is 4. For Mega Bucks, drawn yesterday, the numbers are 10, 12, 23, 26, 31, and 38. Again, Mega Bucks, drawn Wednesday the 27th, the numbers are 10, 12, 23, 26, 31, and 38. Lucky for Life, drawn on Wednesday, the 27th of March. The numbers are 3, 10, 16, 37, 44, with the lucky ball of 4. Again, Lucky for Life, Wednesday, March 27th, 2024. The numbers are 3, 10, 16, 37, 44, and 4. I'll repeat that. 3, 10, 16, 37, 44, and the lucky ball of 4. And on to the news from the front page of the Cape Cod Time. The lead story is entitled, One More Hug. Mourners pack church to say goodbye to Barnstable grad who was killed in Florida. And this is reported by Rachel Devaney. A lone bagpiper played in front of Our Lady of Victory as Megan Moore's family followed behind the 25-year-old's cloth-covered casket into the church on Wednesday. Hundreds of mourners sat in wooden pews or overflowed into the side aisles, greeting the Moore family as they made their way toward Megan's picture, which was at the front of the church. Megan's sister, Molly Moore, took deep breaths as she held tightly to her parents, Billy and Mary Beth Moore. Through tears and tremors, Molly spoke during the funeral service and described Megan as funny, confident, and charismatic. Quote, "Meg, you are one of my most favorite people. I love you with every bit of me. I wish I could have said goodbye, given you one more hug, or had one more drive," Molly Moore said during her speech. Megan Moore, 25, a 2017 Barnstable High School graduate and a 2021 New England College graduate, was shot and killed in what Miami police are calling an apparent murder-suicide on March 16th. Luis Napoles, 40, an alleged co-worker of Megan's, is accused of shooting Moore and her roommate, Sidney Capolino, before taking his own life. According to a statement by the Miami-Dade Police Department's Homicide Bureau, officers responded to a condominium at 7004 Southwest 40th Street, Miami, after reports of shots fired. When they arrived, officers discovered a woman outside of the apartment suffering from an apparent gunshot wound. While rendering aid to the woman, who was later identified as Moore, officers heard the sound of another gunshot from within the apartment. During the service, friends and family members read from the Old and New Testaments, and a gospel was given by the Reverend Chris Hughes. Hughes referred to Megan's departure from life as a tragedy and said her death has greatly impacted the community. "Megan was and is a gift," he said. "She had a zest for life." Hughes says he understands those who feel angry, sad, and hopeless about Megan's death. "She died suddenly, violently, and so soon," said Hughes. But he encouraged all who loved Megan to allow her light to shine through. Quote, "Grief is the price we pay for love," said Hughes. "But I ask the Barnstable community to stand together for the Moore family." End of quote. Megan's older siblings, Molly and Will, stood together at the pulpit toward the end of the service to remember Megan. They spoke about her agility as an ice hockey and field hockey player. Megan tried out and made the Barnstable High School hockey team as an eighth grader, said Will, and went on to play for the women's ice hockey team at New England College. Quote, "She was a natural. Her ability to move around the ice and play the game was incredible," said Molly. "I couldn't believe the athleticism of this girl," close quote. Molly was also a fierce friend, said Will. Through high school athletics, summer sailing programs at the Hyannis Yacht Club, and as a worker at Spanky's Clam Shack, people were automatically attracted to Megan's sense of humor and loyalty, said her older brother. Quote, "All of these things I tried to be, she did so effortlessly," said Will. "When Megan walked in a room, everyone knew it," close quote. Before Megan's death, Will traveled to Florida for 5 weeks and spent time with his sister. Because he only lived 30 minutes away from Megan, the duo shared many dinners and often toured the Miami sights together. The last time Will saw Megan, the siblings watched the Super Bowl. Quote, "What I remember mostly was just sitting in her living room, making dinner, sharing jokes, watching TV, and just being with each other," he said. "She loved her family so much. She had so much empathy for the people she loved," close quote. That's part of the reason why the Moore family decided to establish a foundation in Megan's name geared toward empowering future student athletes. Quote, "Nothing I can say about my little sister can make her death less tragic," said Will. "But he will remember her," he said, "for her ability to be completely and authentically herself." Quote, "My entire life I've been telling stories about Meg to my friends, coworkers, and complete stranger. I got such a kick out of her," he said. "It just kills me there won't be any news stories. Nothing will ever make me smile as big or laugh as hard as Megan could and always did. Close quote. If you are a victim of abuse, there are resources available. If you are in immediate danger, call 911. The National Domestic Violence Hotline, 800-799-7233, is available 24/7. The National Sexual Assault Hotline, 800-656-4673, is available 24/7. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is a hotline for individuals in crisis or for those looking to help someone else. To speak with a certified listener, call 1-800-273-8255. Our next story is entitled Missing Workers from Bridge Presumed Dead. Reported by Tao Nguyen, Christopher Can, and Indian Yancey Bragg for USA Today, Baltimore. Recovery efforts began Wednesday to find the bodies of six missing construction workers after a cargo ship struck the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, causing it to collapse into the Patapsco River. The Dolly, a Singapore-flagged cargo vessel, lost power before it hit a support column of the bridge, officials says. Though a mayday gave authorities on the ground time to halt traffic, eight construction workers on the bridge were plunged into the river. A massive search began early Tuesday with divers, helicopters, and sonar from dozens of agencies being used. Authorities rescued two people before officials called off the search and rescue mission Tuesday evening. The missing workers were presumed dead based on the temperature of the water and the amount of time that had elapsed. Authorities said that after a pause overnight because of strong current and low visibility, they would transition to recovery efforts. Scattered showers across Maryland and much of the Northeast on Wednesday threatened to hamper the recovery mission, according to the National Weather Service. The rain is expected to worsen on Thursday as a large storm system moves over the area following a cold front. Officials have cited the temperature of the water as a major issue complicating divers' ability to search the river. Quote, "We do not know where they are, but we intend to give our best effort to help those families find closure," said Colonel Roland L. Butler, Jr., Maryland State Police Superintendent. A Baltimore nonprofit identified a father of three from El Salvador as one of the six missing construction workers. In a news release, CASA said Miguel Luna, who has lived in Maryland for over 19 years, didn't return home after he left for work on Monday around 6:30 p.m. He was a longtime member of CASA, a nonprofit day worker center that provides assistance for workers and immigrant families. Quote, "Providing humanitarian support during this crisis is the priority as families navigate this tragedy and seek answers about their missing loved ones," Gustavo Torres, CASA's executive director, said in a statement. Quote, "The entire Baltimore region and CASA family is lamenting this tragedy," close quote. Maynor Yacir Suazo Sandoval, 38, a Honduran national who arrived in the U.S. about two decades ago, was also among the missing, according to Wilson Paz, Director General of the Protection of Honduran Migrants. Honduran officials made contact with Suazo Sandoval's brother in Honduras and another sibling in the U.S. Late Tuesday, the Mexican consulate in Washington, D.C., confirmed that there were Mexican people missing, but did not specify how many. The Guatemalan Ministry of Foreign Affairs also confirmed two Guatemalan nationals, ages 26 and 35, went missing while working on the bridge, but did not release their names. The University of Maryland Medical Center said its trauma center treated and discharged one of the two rescued men. The workers were employed by Bronner Builders, a Maryland-based construction firm that is contracted by the Maryland Transportation Authority and several public agencies in the Baltimore area. The company has 8 building inspection units, according to its website. The crew of 22 Indian nationals who were aboard the Dali cargo ship when it crashed into the Key Bridge had not left the vessel as of Wednesday morning, U.S. Coast Guard spokesperson Cynthia Oldham told USA Today. Officials on Tuesday said inspectors had to make sure it was safe to board the ship before the crew could be taken to shore, and investigators with the National Transportation Safety Board, which has assumed the investigation, could begin an on-site probe. NTSB investigators were able to board the Dali on Tuesday night and were scheduled to begin interviewing crew members on Wednesday, CNN reported, citing Jennifer Homendy, the agency's chair. The investigation will also include interviews with officials who were on the bridge just before the crash and whether there were, quote, major deficiencies on the ship, according to Homendy. The agency is aware of the reported power issues on the cargo ship, Homendy said, which investigations need to verify. A U.S. official who was not authorized to speak publicly told USA Today that the ship's power loss could be related to mechanical failure. Dali had been involved in at least one accident prior to Tuesday's crash. While the 9-year-old container ship had passed previous inspections, officials discovered a deficiency with its, quote, propulsion and auxiliary machinery, gauges, thermometers, etc., during an inspection in June at the port of San Antonio in Chile, according to the Tokyo MOU, an intergovernmental maritime authority in the Asia-Pacific region. Sources familiar with the investigation told the Wall Street Journal that investigators will examine whether contaminated fuel may have caused the ship's power problems. Joseph Barbera, an associate professor at George Washington University, whose research focuses on emergency and risk management, said it will likely take weeks before the massive cargo vessel can be cleared from the river. He said experts will have to conduct structural evaluations before deciding how best to move the ship so the massive chunks of steel can be taken out of the water. Inspectors will have to secure the fuel, determine the state of the engines, and decide whether they'd want to remove some of the containers to lessen the weight of the ship. This article is entitled, Governor Healey Talks Safety of Cape Cod's Bridges During Meeting. This is reported by Colin A. Young. Governor Maura Healey met Tuesday afternoon with various state agencies, the U.S. Coast Guard, and the Massachusetts Maritime Academy to talk about bridge and port safety in the wake of the early morning collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore. A cargo ship leaving Baltimore's port reportedly lost power and collided with the foundation of the bridge, causing the immediate failure of the span that carries Interstate 695 over the harbor early Tuesday morning. Quote, "And when I leave you, I will be returning to my office where I'm convening with the Coast Guard, Mass DOT, which is Department of Transportation, Mass Port, as well as Mass Maritime, which we're really lucky to have Mass Maritime here in Massachusetts. Many of the men and women who operate those ships and do that work were trained at Mass Maritime," the governor said. "But I want to make sure that we're having a conversation to make sure that all of our protocols are where they need to be and that we are doing everything that we can to ensure the safety of our ports and our bridges," close quote. Healey said the Tobin Bridge, the largest bridge in New England that soars over the Mystic River, carrying Route 1 between Boston and Chelsea, was inspected, quote, "as recently as a couple of months ago," close quote. Some larger ships pass beneath the Tobin, but not the same cargo ships that generally use the Conley Terminal in South Boston. Quote, "It's a regularly occurring thing that our bridges are inspected. As I said, the Tobin was inspected a couple of months ago. If on inspection we identify any issues, we would work hard to take care of that and will continue to do that," Healey said. She added, Certainly, we want to make sure that we have the best protocols in place. Our inspections are up to date, and as I say, if we identify any issues, we're going to address them. Close quote. The governor called the situation in Baltimore absolutely devastating and heartbreaking, and told GBH that she was, quote, actually supposed to be meeting with Maryland Governor Wes Moore this morning, but that Moore had to fly back in the middle of the night to attend to this. I've been in touch with him. I've offered our support as a state to Maryland and to Baltimore, she said. My thoughts are with all of the victims and survivors, all those affected by this tragedy. Huge kudos to the first responders, men and women, who are in the water right now and in the air looking for survivors in what is becoming a recovery effort at this point. Close quote. Later in the interview, Boston Public Radio co-host Jim Broud asked Healy whether she, like he and his co-host Marjorie Egan, is nervous any time she has to drive over the Sagamore Bridge getting to or from Cape Cod. Quote, no. I mean, I'll tell you, the Sagamore Bridge has been inspected and has been labeled structurally deficient, which is why we want the bridges replaced. That said, structurally deficient doesn't mean unsafe, because what happens is when there is that designation, there was work immediately done to ensure safe passage, but it doesn't take away from the fact that we actually need to have these bridges replaced. Close quote. MassDOT and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers rolled out a new memorandum of understanding last week. Under the agreement, the state will commit $700 million in funding toward replacement of the aging Cape Cod bridges, starting with the Sagamore, and the Corps will provide another $600 million, subject to congressional appropriation. The Biden administration in December awarded a $372 million grant toward the Sagamore Bridge replacement, and a federal appropriations bill includes another $350 million. And an application for more than $1 billion in federal bridge investment program money remains under consideration. Quote, infrastructure, state of good repair, it's really, really important, Healy said Tuesday, and we just haven't done it for too long. Close quote. After Tuesday afternoon's meeting, Transportation Secretary Monica Tibbetts-Nutt and Highway Administrator Jonathan Gulliver held a news conference to share information on the state's bridges, ports, and infrastructure. Gulliver said Massachusetts has two bridges similar to the Francis Scott Key Bridge in that they are truss bridges over a maritime navigation channel, the Tobin and the Braga Bridge in Fall River. With the Braga and with the Tobin Bridge, there are precautions that are taken. There are certain guidelines and certain requirements that are imposed upon us as we build those projects, as we maintain and replace those bridges, to ensure that they meet modern standards and that they remain safe, and safe for use by marine traffic as well, Gulliver said. Quote, so I can tell you from a standpoint of, is there a lot of similarity between Massachusetts and Baltimore? There is not. We are not the same size port as they have in Baltimore. We don't have the same size navigable waterways, nor the same size bridges, close quote. Gulliver said MassDOT is responsible for about 5,000 bridges in Massachusetts, with roughly 12% of them listed as structurally deficient. He said MassDOT does bridge inspections every day and that each bridge is inspected at least every 2 years. And our final article from the front page of the Cape Cod Times. Data seen as help to Cape Chamber tourism economy. This is reported by Denise Coffey. Tourism, the state's third largest industry, brought Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll and Kate Fox, Executive Director of the State Office of Travel and Tourism, to Cape Cod on Wednesday. They were in town to tout the state's initiatives to help tourism-related businesses thrive. For the first time in 5 years, tourism has been included in a Massachusetts governor's economic development plan and economic development bill. Statewide marketing initiatives and a tourism website will be launched, and $40 million in destination development grants will be funded. Over 150 hospitality professionals were expected at the forum held at the DoubleTree by Hilton, Cape Cod. Four of the top five industries on the Cape are tourism-related. More than 5 million visitors generated more than $181 million in state and local tax receipts in 2023, according to the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce. Tourism-related industries supported 12,000 Cape workers. How to level out the peaks and valleys of the seasons, how to extend the shoulder seasons before and after summer months, and how to more effectively target travelers and market to them is what the Cape Cod Chamber is hoping to do with data from Zartico, a company that compiles data for marketing purposes. Bill Obreiter, a Zartico vice president, said the granular data helps the chamber and its members understand the impact of events, see who is traveling to the Cape and where they are coming from. "We can get down to the zip codes," Obreiter said. "Looking at the data can help members extend their peak season," he said. A better understanding of in-state and out-of-state visitor travel, when people arrive and when they depart, how much they spend on lodging and so forth, can help them target their marketing more effectively, he said. It's all about using limited resources and funding on impactful messages for targeted audiences, according to Obreiter. The Massachusetts Office of Travel and Tourism is the state agency dedicated to promoting Massachusetts as a leisure travel destination. An integral part of the state's economy, tourism generates $1.5 billion in state and local taxes and $22.9 billion in travel-related spending, and supports 149,400 in-state jobs. Outdoor recreation brings about $11 billion to the state annually. There's a picture on page 3 of the Cape and Islands Cape Cod Times, which shows two firefighters who you can barely see because of heavy smoke and the water that they're pouring out. And the caption is, "Crews from the Hyannis Fire Department on Tuesday put out a fire of burning plastic outdoor furniture stored on the tennis court at the Cape Codder Resort in Hyannis. The blaze sent a heavy black plume of smoke out across Hyannis." We have reached about the middle of our broadcast, so we move on to obituaries. There are four today. The first is for Michael Mark Allen, Port St. Lucie. "It is with a very heavy heart that we share the passing of Michael M. Allen, age 68, peacefully in his home on March the 12th, 2024. He left this world after a long and courageous battle with cancer. Born in Brockton on July the 23rd, 1955, Michael was the third child of four to Harry and Janet Allen, formerly of Brockton. Michael was a 1973 graduate of Brockton High School and attended University of Massachusetts Amherst. Michael is survived by his devoted and lovely wife, Lisa Allen, and his cat, Bailey, whom he loved dearly as well. Michael was the son of Harry and Janet Allen and the brother of Brian Allen and his partner, Pam Fine, and Barry Allen and his wife, Vicky, and his sister, Carrie Shapiro, and her husband, Hugh. He also leaves behind many nieces and nephews and great-nieces and nephews and cousins. Relatives and friends are respectfully invited to attend a brief service at Duane Beale and Ames Funeral Home at 729 Massachusetts Route 134, South Dennis, Massachusetts, on Saturday, April the 6th, 2024, at 11 a.m. A graveside burial service at Oak Ridge Cemetery in Dennis, Mass., immediately following the service. In lieu of flowers, donations in memory of Michael M. Allen may be made to Dogs and Cats Forever, a no-kill shelter, 4600 Selvitz Road, Fort Pierce, Florida, 34981-34981. As Michael had an unending devotion to all animals, although cats were his passion. Our second obituary is for John H. McCormick, Jr., South Yarmouth. Born in Quincy, Massachusetts, the son of John H. McCormick and Philomena Gallagher McCormick. His loving wife of 67 years, Joanne Ryan McCormick, predeceased him in December 2020. Jack is predeceased by his brother, James S. McCormick, and Phyllis McCormick Slattery. John, Jack, graduated from Quincy High School in 1948 and was soon hired by the Boston Globe newspaper company. Jack became a photo engraver apprentice and joined the Graphic Arts Union. He went on to work for the Globe for 45 years. During his tenure at the Globe, Jack earned the prestigious scholarship to the Harvard University Trade Union Program. In true Jack form, he participated in numerous causes, ranging from chairman of the Globe employee Blood Bank to president of the Globe Quarter Century Club to delegate of the IPEU National Convention, and most notably, a stint as the Globe Santa. He and his wife Joanne settled in Braintree, Massachusetts, where they raised their 5 children. He consistently served his community while raising his children and was co-founder and president of Braintree Youth Hockey. He was also an avid sailor and member of the Hyannis Yacht Club, sailing in the Figawi race and working on HYC race committee boats. He and Joanne retired in 1992 to Yarmouth, where they had a summer home for many years. Jack continued to contribute to his community in retirement. He served as a member of the Yarmouth Planning Board, the Community and Economic Development Committee, served as the Yarmouth representative to the Cape Cod Tech High School, and was an active member of the Cape Cod Commission for 10 years, where he served as chair and co-chair. In 2017, Jack was aptly named as Yarmouth Citizen of the Year and served as mayor of the South Yarmouth St. Patrick's Day Parade. Jack was a staunch believer in giving back and serving his community. He loved to travel with his wife, and everywhere he went, people gravitated toward his benevolent nature. He was bright, funny, and unbeatable at board games and Jeopardy, particularly if he recruited Joanne to his team. Above all, Jack was a lover of life and a true family man who adored his family. His often-heard refrain was, quote, "Every day I get up in the morning is a good day," close quote. Jack also leaves behind his 5 children, John H. III and his wife Jean of Stoughton, Edward and his wife Wendy of Lakeville, Terrence and his wife Pammy of Renham, Lori Griffiths and her husband Thomas of Yarmouth, and his daughter Jane of Kingston. Known as PJ to his 9 grandchildren, he was the proud grandfather of Erin Griffiths Renault and her husband Eric of Duxbury, McKaylee McCormick Finney and her husband Mike of Wareham, Ryan Griffiths of Yarmouth, Thomas Griffiths Jr. and his wife Samantha of Yarmouth, Jack Goldberg of Simi Valley, California, Donovan McCormick of Renham, Caroline McCormick of Renham, Ethan Wager of Salem, New Hampshire, and Alicia Wager of New Bedford. He is also survived by great-grandchildren, Owen Pope of Wareham, Reese Finney, Kira Finney, and Aubrey Finney of Hanson, and Henry Renault, Emerson Renault, and William Renault of Duxbury. There will be a funeral mass on Tuesday, April the 2nd at 11 a.m. at St. Pius X Church, 5 Barbara Street, Yarmouth, with burial to immediately follow at the Chandler Gray Cemetery in Yarmouth. A celebration of life gathering with friends and family will be held following the services. Words of comfort in John's name can be left at www.chapmanfuneral.com. In lieu of flowers, donations in Jack's memory may be made to Capabilities, 895 Mary Dunn Road, Hyannis, Massachusetts, 02601, or Capabilities, that's one word, .org, where his grandson, Ryan Griffiths, receives care and services. Our next obituary is for Manuel G. Macara. Manuel G. Macara, Jr., age 89, of Truro, Massachusetts, passed away peacefully on Saturday, March 23rd, with his children by his side. Manny, or Junior, as his friends and family called him, was born on July 11th, 1934, in Provincetown, the son of the late Manuel G. Macara and Inez Chapman Macara. Born into a fishing family, he would tell you the sea was his second life, and as a young child would often be found with his father and brother working aboard the Victory I and Victory II. Then, after graduating Provincetown High School in 1952, he chose to enroll in the service with the U.S. Coast Guard, beginning a 26-year career that saw him become a chief warrant officer, which led him to meet his beloved wife, Patricia R. O'Leary, in Biddleford, Maine. The two were married in 1955 and spent those early years stationed throughout New England until Manny's retirement from service in 1978, when they returned to Cape Cod, building their home in Truro. This return also brought Manny back to fishing, and soon thereafter he purchased his own vessel, naming it after his sweetheart, Pat C., and spending another 13 years on the water. Throughout his life, he was an avid golfer, and after selling the boat, he was able to pursue his love of golfing by becoming the manager at the Truro Highland Links Golf Course for about 10 years. Throughout his life, Manny was devoted to his faith, his family, and his community. He was a proud member of the Knights of Columbus, Lions Club, St. Vincent de Paul, and the American Legion. Above all, though, Manny was a beloved brother, husband, father, grandfather, and great-grandpapa. He was predeceased by his wife, Patricia, and his brother, Kenneth R. Macara. He is survived by his sister, Inez Johns, of Indiana, sons Manuel G. Macara III of California, and Randall D. Macara of Revere, daughters Roxanne M. Macara and Linda L. Macara and her partner, Timothy Rose, of Truro, as well as three granddaughters, Nicole Conrad, Rebecca Blome, and Kelly Blome, several great-grandchildren, and many, many nieces and cousins and nephews. Families and friends are invited to attend a funeral mass at St. Peter the Apostle Church in Provincetown on Wednesday, April the 3rd at 10 a.m. A private burial will be held later in the spring. In lieu of flowers, if desired, donations in Manuel's memory may be made to VNA Hospice of Cape Cod at 25 Communication Way in Hyannis, Massachusetts, 02601. For online condolences, please visit www.nickersonfunerals.com. And our final obituary for today is for Anne M. Aubin, Duxbury. Anne M. Trainer Aubin, 85, died unexpectedly in the early morning of March 21st, 2024, in her home. She was born on July 7th, 1938, in Dorchester, Mass., to Helen Jennings Trainer and Michael Andrew Trainer, as the youngest of 11 children. She is predeceased by her parents and 10 siblings. Anne was the loving wife of the late Richard E. Aubin. and is the mother of Lisa A. Aubin of Barnstable, Mass., Richard E. Aubin of Garland, Texas., Kathleen M. Aubin and her husband Robert Pickering of Natick, Mass., Nana of Michaela and Lily Matthew of Barnstable, Mass., Jack Pickering of Natick, Mass., and Antoinette, Olivia, Eleanor, and Genevieve Aubin of Garland, Texas., and many nieces and nephews. Visiting hours will be held on Tuesday, April the 2nd, from 5 to 8 p.m. at Chapman Funerals and Cremations, Blute Chapel, 678 Main Street, Harwich Center. A funeral mass will be celebrated on Wednesday, April the 3rd at 11 a.m. at St. Pius X Church, 5 Barbara Street, South Yarmouth. A private burial at Massachusetts National Cemetery will be at a later date. Donations in Anne's memory may be made to the PMC Rider Lisa Theoharidis, LT0029, who will be riding in her 23rd Pan Mass Challenge this summer. Notes of comfort may be made to her family at www.chapmanfuneral.com. And for sports news, this article is looking ahead. Here are our bold predictions for the men's NCAA tourney Sweet 16 by Paul Meyerberg, Eric Smith, and Eddie Timanis. To pick number one, Connecticut, to beat number five, San Diego State, and reach the Elite Eight, that's not very bold. To predict that Coach Dan Hurley will crack a smile, no, that's bold. The Sweet 16 of the NCAA Men's Tournament begins on Thursday, that's today, with East and West Region semifinals featuring the Huskies and fellow number one seed North Carolina, which seems headed for a shootout against number four Alabama. Also on Tuesday, number two Arizona faces number six Clemson, and number two Iowa State plays number three Illinois. On Friday, number two Marquette takes on number 11 North Carolina State, and number one Houston plays number four Duke in the South Region, while number one Purdue meets number five Gonzaga, and number two Tennessee plays number three Creighton in the Midwest. Now's the time for teams to make that championship push. It's also time to be bold. Here are USA Today Sports bold predictions for this week's Sweet 16. All the number one seeds will reach the Final Four. Eddie Timanis is already on record predicting this on his experts bracket, so he backs it up here in this prediction. It might not seem very bold, but in the 64-team era, it's only happened once in 2008. Three of the four have breezed through up to this point, but none of them have an easy path ahead. History and the odds say at least one of them won't make it, but we're all about being bold here. Duke will beat Houston, but should a number one fall? Which Duke squad shows up, the one that played listlessly against number 13 Vermont, or the one that played with high energy and enthusiasm in a dominant win against number two James Madison? If it's the latter, the number four Blue Devils have the talent and depth to take down an opponent that struggled amid some major foul trouble to put down a number nine Texas A&M in overtime. The big keys are continued excellence from three-point range from guards Jared McCain and Tyrese Proctor, who went on a combined 12 of 21 from deep against the Dukes to keep the big man Kyle Filipowski involved after his slow start to the postseason. Dan Hurley will be a happy person. Hurley's been on a quest to find something wrong with the defending national champions. Blowouts of number 16 Stetson, 91-52, and number 9 Northwestern, 75-58, have left him picking on the Huskies' performance in the second half, which makes sense given that UConn led at halftime by 33 and 22 points, respectively. Here's maybe the boldest prediction of March Madness, Thursday night's rematch of last year's title game against San Diego State will actually make Hurley beam as his team sends yet another opponent packing by a double-digit margin. The Huskies' 8 tournament wins in a row have come by an average of 22 points. Alabama and North Carolina will require a second official scorer. Okay, this may be a bit of an exaggeration, but given the pace that the Crimson Tide love to play and the ability of the Tar Heels to thrive in an open court environment, we could be looking at one of the highest scoring games of the tournament Thursday. Alabama has scored at least 90 points in 8 games since the start of February. It has allowed at least 88 9 times in the same span. Don't expect Alabama coach Nat Oates to go conservative now that the stakes of the tournament have gotten higher. Just sit back and watch the wildness unfold. Iowa State will clamp down on Illinois. Illinois' defense has been one of the best in the nation for the better part of 2 months, and senior guard Terrence Shannon may be the top scorer in this year's tournament. Shannon has scored 56 points through 2 games, lifting his season average to 23.3 points per game. But the Illinois will run into a wall against the Cyclones, who head into Thursday ranked 4th nationally in scoring defense, 61.3 points per game, 12th in opposing field goal percentage, 40.2%, and 2nd in forced turnovers, 17.3 per game. Tennessee moves one step closer to the Final Four. Yes, we know about the Volunteers and their confounding NCAA tournament woes, especially recently with Rick Barnes. Heck, they could have been sent home in the 2nd round against Texas, but there may be a silver lining given how poorly Tennessee shot against the Longhorns and still managed to survive. The shooting can't be that bad Friday against Creighton, can it? Even if they do struggle offensively, the Volunteers can rely on their defense against the Blue Jays and advance. Someone will record a triple-double in this round. We've already had one in the tournament, courtesy of Illinois' Marcus Domask. They're a little more difficult to come by in the later rounds as the competition gets tougher, but there are a number of candidates. The most obvious is Purdue's Zach Edey, who nearly always has points and rebounds covered. Blocks may be hard to get, as his opponents often don't challenge him enough, but he could also do it with assists, as his passing out of the post is a somewhat underappreciated aspect of his game. Marquette's Tyler Kolek is another possibility, likely to have points and assists covered, but probably in need of a few fortuitous bounces to get the required 10 boards. Do everything guys like UConn's Tristan Newton or Iowa State's Tommen Lipsey could also pull it off. Barnstable residents can apply to housing and zoning committees, reported by Heather McCarron. Barnstable residents have until April the 19th to apply to be on 2 new ad hoc committees, one on housing and one focused on zoning. Adding new voices to make decisions about the town's housing, in particular, is important, according to comments made at a March 21st town council meeting. Quote, I have been watching this council and its adversarial approach to housing of all types in our community. I'm here to offer my experience and thoughts, not only on housing on Main Street in Hyannis, but in Barnstable in general, close quote, said Tara Vargas Wallace, CEO of Amplify POC Cape Cod. Amplify POC Cape Cod is a nonprofit in Hyannis that promotes racial equality. Vargas Wallace said she was at the March 21 meeting, quote, together with the NAACP in solidarity, as we stand together to move forward with equitable housing in Barnstable, close quote. Barnstable residents interested in getting appointed to new ad hoc committees on housing and zoning can submit applications at the Town Council's webpage by visiting the Town Hall at 367 Main Street or by requesting an application by mail. The deadline is April the 19th. The town council on March the 21st voted to create 5 advisory committees suggested by Council President Felicia Penn to examine some of the town's most pressing problems. 2 of the committees, one tasked with reviewing strategies for creating housing and one that will review zoning and the town's use of regulatory agreements, include seats for residents at large. Penn has emphasized that when the ad hoc committees are up and running, they are expected to hold fully public meetings that will be posted according to the state open meeting law, and that will include public comment periods. The committees will all be expected to report regularly to the council up until they are ready to make their final report and recommendations for the council's consideration. Penn on Monday said she plans to make the appointments, as is the prerogative of the council president, by the end of April. At that March 21st meeting, council members debated having the town appointments committee review candidates and make recommendations to the full council because of recent concerns about transparency, but the suggestion failed on a 6-6 vote, with one councilor absent. Penn noted the original deadline to apply was March 28th, since the ad hoc committees were first expected to be discussed and voted upon during the council's March 7th meeting. Quote, but Councillor Paul Neary made a motion to postpone the item until the March 21st meeting, so the date was recalculated to April 19th for both councillors and the public to reply, she said in an email. Councillors have been asked to submit their own requests also by April 19th for appointments to 3 councillor-only committees. These panels will review the town council's rules and town code, look at the, quote, purpose, composition, functionality, and effectiveness of the town's more than 40 standing committees, and consider policy related to the town's acquisition, disposal, and development of town-owned property. Councillors and residents alike have highlighted the lack of affordable housing as a critical problem in Barnstable. Vargas Wallace emphasized at the March 21st meeting the importance of getting diverse perspectives represented in the discussions. Also at the meeting, Lynn Rhodes, president of the NAACP Cape Cod, said that on a whim, she looked into finding an apartment, and the one she found was listed at $21,000 per month for a one-bedroom. If the cost of housing is assumed to be about 30% of a person's income, she said, affording that apartment would mean she'd need to earn $99,000 a year. Quote, if you think that someone who's going to be serving you coffee at Dunkin' Donuts, serving you a hamburger at McDonald's, can afford that, it's astronomical, Rhodes said. When people who work in service jobs cannot afford to live in Barnstable or cannot afford to patronize businesses themselves, quote, it's going to affect the economy, Rhodes said. At the same meeting, resident Carolyn Newman said housing is a town-wide struggle, not only for newcomers. Quote, I have 3 grandchildren that I would love for them to be able to stay on the Cape. Will they be able to? Doesn't look like it now, she said. Newman is considering the need to move herself, despite her good salary. Quote, I'm hoping that with all of us working together, we can come up with some creative solutions, she said. She also supported the idea of keeping discussions all out in the public. Close. And our final article today is entitled, Case Brings Skeptical Justices Together. Supreme Court Considers Suit Against Abortion Pill. And this is reported by Maureen Gropp and Dan Morrison. A Supreme Court bitterly divided 2 years ago over the right to an abortion appeared to find something close to unity Tuesday as conservative and liberal justices took turns picking apart the arguments of a small group of anti-abortion doctors seeking to roll back access to the widely used abortion drug mifepristone. Justice Neil Gorsuch, a Donald Trump appointee who voted in 2022 to overturn the constitutional right to an abortion, groused that, quote, a handful of individuals were trying to make health policy for the entire country. The case, Gorsuch said, quote, seems like a prime example of turning what could be a small lawsuit into a national legislative assembly on an FDA rule or any other federal government action, close quote. Tuesday's arguments were a big speed bump for a crucial abortion case that has so far sailed through lower courts with key arguments intact. The case sent shockwaves across the medical and legal worlds last year when a Trump-appointed district judge in Amarillo, Texas, suspended the FDA's 20-year-old approval of mifepristone. The right-leaning Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in Louisiana restored the FDA's approval but upheld other parts of his decision, setting the stage for a high court showdown that saw strident anti-abortion and abortion rights protesters facing off on the streets outside. The hearing generated intense interest in part because the doctors have sought to use the Comstock Act, a 19th-century anti-obscenity law, to ban the delivery of mifepristone by mail. But with the exception of Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, the court mostly ignored the 1873 law and focused on the anti-abortion doctors. The Supreme Court has experienced strong divisions over recent cases involving issues including abortion, affirmative action, and gun rights. But there were moments Tuesday when the justices seemed to line up to get in their own skeptical questions about the doctors standing to sue, the broad restrictions they demanded, and whether the FDA's decisions can be second-guessed by the judiciary. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson pressed Aaron Hawley, the doctor's attorney, to provide an example of an anti-abortion physician who had been forced to violate their ethics by treating a woman suffering from a mifepristone-related emergency. Hawley replied that she couldn't because, quote, doctors don't necessarily know until they scrub in to that operating room whether this may or may not be abortion drug harm. It could be a miscarriage, it could be an ectopic pregnancy, or it could be an elective abortion, close quote. Solicitor General Elizabeth Preloger had earlier told the court the doctor's argument was unduly speculative. Quote, we think that that situation has never come to pass, she said. The doctors haven't identified any incident in more than 20 years that mifepristone has been available on the market that resembles that kind of hypothetical situation, close quote. Justice Clarence Thomas, who voted last year to roll back the drug's availability while Tuesday's case was being litigated, went after the doctor's claim that the very fact that they felt compelled to sue counted as an injury requiring the court's intervention. Quote, that would be anyone who is aggressive or vigilant about bringing lawsuits just simply by using resources to advocate their position in court, you say now, causes an injury. That seems easy to manufacture, Thomas said. Hawley, who is married to Senator Josh Hawley, Republican from Missouri, said this case was different because the doctors had analyzed studies and combed through FDA data. Quote, is that it? Justice Amy Coney Barrett later asked. Cora Truefrost, a Syracuse University law professor, said that by tackling the apparent weaknesses in the doctors standing to sue and the broad remedies they demanded, the court was avoiding the knottier question of whether the judiciary should have a say in science-based decisions like the approval of drugs by the FDA. For the court to engage the merits of those arguments, they would be substituting their judgment for those of the experts at the FDA, Truefrost told USA Today. Focusing on the threshold issue of standing is a classic judicial move to conserve court resources and avoid making cases the court would rather not make. Chief Justice John Roberts asked why the case couldn't be limited to the people involved in one region rather than blocking the FDA from allowing the drug everywhere. Quote, "I think it might be impractical," Hawley said, "because the FDA regulation would remain in place," quote, "and permit things like mail order abortions," close quote. That's all we have time for today. This is Daphne reading the Cape Cod Times for Thursday, March the 28th, 2024. For those of you who celebrate it, may you have a very happy and blessed Easter weekend.